من يريد الله به خيرا يفقهه في الدين.
None of them would ever say about someone who prays our way, a disbeliever he's become because of some sin he's done. After the Ummah has split into 73 sects, know that all the groups, names, sects, and labels, all of them are in the fire, except for one. One label Allah has ordered us with, and only one, and that is Muslims. Welcome to Outlining Fiqh. We have with us here today Sheikh Abu Toba and several students of fiqh from around the world. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
كيف حالك شيخ؟
لا بأس الحمد لله أنا بخير وأنتم؟
الحمد لله I'm doing fine. Thanks for asking. We are in a summary of Islamic jurisprudence by Sheikh Saleh Fawzan. This is Unit 6, Chapter 7. The unit is on marriage and the chapter is Defects in Spouses. And if you're following along in the PDF file of the English translation, the page number will be 402. But if you're in the printed book, the page number is 385. So, here we go. Let's begin. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Defects in spouses. There are defects that, if found in one of the married couple, the other has the right of option whether to cancel the marriage contract or not. The following are some examples. 1. If a wife finds out that her husband is unable to copulate with her due to his impotency, she has the right to rescind the marriage contract. In addition, if a woman claims that her husband is impotent and the latter does not deny it, the husband is to be given a chance for a year to copulate with her. Yet, if he still could not copulate with her during that period, she has the right to rescind the marriage contract.
Okay, so this time frame that's given is not from the Sunnah. Okay?
Naam.
Does that mean this is again, when you have some things like that, you know, you have to realize that this is a ruling that a sheikh has given regarding how to deal with that issue. What is true from the issue is that the wife has the right to rescind the marriage if her husband is found to be impotent. What is not clear is how much time he's given to disprove that, or, you know, how much time she's given to establish that. Okay? Some of the people that I have seen in practice give him from the time he has married her to the days that he has to, you know, the first days he has to stay with her. Do you get my point?
So in other words, immediately.
Well, it depends. It depends. They give that time frame because this is normally when people start to have sex with one another. Okay. Now, if they both agreed that they were not going to have sex during that time, then of course the issue is dropped. As long as the spouse doesn't have a problem with it, the spouse that is not receiving intercourse. The same thing happened. We had a case of a man whose wife did not want to have sex for some reason or another, and he stayed married to her for 2 years. Okay, or it might have been longer. It was at least 2 years, and he was patient. And then he wanted to get a second wife. He said, well, I want to get another wife. And she refused. No, you can't get a wife on me. And so then this whole thing came up about that he hadn't had sex with her in 2 years. You know, so it's all about what the spouse, where their breaking point is. And there's no Sharia statement saying it has to be in this time frame. You get my point?
Nah. Is this something which is up to the it's up to the cultural expectation?
No, it's up to the people involved, not even the cultural expectations. It's up to the people involved themselves. And there are certain issues in the Sharia that go back to the person himself, and that person makes the rule. If a wife or a husband, let's say it's normally here, impotence is only on the side of the man, because a woman is on the receiving end of sex. Okay? Does that make sense?
Yes, sir. Makes sense.
Okay. So, if he can't literally get it up to have sex, then that is on him. If she's patient with that, she can be patient up to the rest of her life. There's no ruling saying that she has to complain about this. Okay? Or she can say immediately, he tried and he didn't do it. I don't think he can do it. Okay? And then it can immediately become an issue. So it goes back to the person. And on the other end, when it's not an impotence thing, but it's a I don't want to thing, the man can wait as long as he wants to. There's nothing saying he has to, you know, wait 3 days or 4 days, when he has a right to and she has a right to, but they can give that up as long as they want to. Does what am I saying make any sense?
Yes, sir. It makes sense.
Yes, sir.
What was that?
Continue.
You said something?
Continue, please. Yes, continue, please.
Okay. Excuse me. I thought Berica had said something.
Yeah, okay. He said he agreed. Okay. He said he agreed. It makes sense.
Okay. Number two, if the husband finds that his wife is afflicted with a shortcoming that hampers copulation, such as colpatresia.
Okay, this is what we call it buruda in Arabic. It's called buruda. And buruda is what I was just describing to you, is that she's cold to sex. She's not turned on. She doesn't get hot. Okay? So, and this happens a lot of times when the women have their clitorises completely cut off. Okay? And this is a torture to someone. Some women, the sex has become painful to them. Okay? Because of this. And some women get sick, you know, because of this. So, you know, this could be the case, and you never know until you try to have intercourse with the woman. Does that make sense?
Yes. If the husband finds that his wife is afflicted with a shortcoming that hampers copulation, such as colpatresia, and that such a defect is incurable, the husband then has the right to rescind the marriage contract. Three.
Okay, I noticed that a lot of times in this particular case, in most cases, and like I said, we call it buruda, from the word batted, to be cold. Normally, the men don't push for the divorce. I noticed that. Normally, when the woman is dealing with the man who has impotence, she does push for the divorce. At the most, the man says, I want to get another wife. And this is because men receive from women and recognize that they receive from women more than just sex. Okay? And nor do we look towards them in all cases just to protect. We even encourage to like the peacefulness they might give us in the home, the cleanliness, the organization, and those things. And of course, we'd love to have sex with them. But if that one thing is missing, it doesn't do away with all the other things. And of course, because man in a marriage can also find another wife to have sex with. Whereas a woman, she's in a difficult situation. If he can't intercourse with her, then she has no alternative but to do without. And so that may be a more difficult situation for her to deal with. So we normally find the woman calling for the divorce in both cases more than the man does. Okay?
Nam. Three, if one of the two spouses finds a defect in the other, such as hemorrhoids, insanity, vitiligo, leprosy, baldness, or halitosis, the former then has the right of choice, whether to cancel the marriage contract or not, due to the repulsion caused by such defects.
Okay, so these things are considered, you know, like things mentioned, you know, they're not pretty. And someone would have to deal with that. You know, we say this, I'm not trying to be vulgar, but when a person first gets married, they don't pass gas around each other. That they're such on their good behavior, they don't pass gas around each other. But then You know, we find when I'm dealing with marital discourse, sometimes the one or the other will complain, well, this person passes gas around me like they don't care. Another one might say, yeah, so what? I mean, we've been married like this. Another one might say, well, you know what? It was in the beginning, you didn't do that. You know, now you're just disgusting. You know, sometimes they blame the guy for that. And what it is people get used to each other and they can put up with each other passing gas, let's say, for instance, because, you know, you're in a close environment. What can you do? You can't hide it forever. But if you start off the relationship, you know, with passing gas around the other person and stuff like that, that would be that repulsive to the person. I'm saying that to say this, that of the things that you mentioned, like hemorrhoids or halitosis or name some of the other things you named. Could you name them again, please?
Insanity.
Okay. Insanity. What else?
Baldness.
Baldness. All those things a person may experience from their spouse during the life of the marriage. Okay. He may or she may come up with halitosis sometime because of what they're eating or what they're going through. They might be going through a bad spell, not drinking enough water and doing something. They may have bad breath for a little bit of time. They can get over that. The man may lose his hair and go bald. Sometimes women lose their hair during pregnancy or during their nursing period, and it may come back. And sometimes women go crazy when they're in pregnancy or postpartum or just go get depressed, or the man goes crazy or has PTSD or something like that, you know. But, oh, hemorrhoids. Women are known for getting hemorrhoids after birth. So it's not that these things in and of themselves are so repulsive, but it's to start off the relationship like that, which is repulsive. Okay, so there's no money in the emotional bank account for you to put up with that yet. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
There you are.
Now, the great scholar Ibn al-Qayyim said, every defect that causes a spouse to be disinclined to the other and prevents the fulfillment of the purpose of marriage, i.e. copulation, entails the right of choice, whether to cancel it or not. Invalidation, in this case, is worthier than the invalidation of a trade transaction due to a defect.
No.
Into the Sheikh's words. The right of option to rescind the marriage contract is due to the spouse who does not accept the defect of the other, even if the former has a similar or a different defect. This is because the man does not feel disgusted with his own defects. However, if any of the married couple accepts the defect of the other, provided being aware of the defect and showing a sign of acceptance, such as saying, I accept that defect, such a spouse does not have the right of option to rescind the marriage contract due to that defect afterwards. When one of the married couple has the right of option to rescind the marriage contract or not, the execution must be done by the judge or the one in authority, as such a matter needs ijtihad and consideration. Thus, the judge or the one in authority can rescind the marriage contract if demanded by the claimant spouse, or give the latter permission to do so.
And this is why we need judges in the United States and Canada.
Now, Sheikh, I have a question about, you've mentioned that several times, that we need judges. I wanted to ask you, if we're living in a non-Muslim country, what is the purpose of having a judge if it's known already that the judge cannot enforce his decisions?
The enforcement is halfway upon the person. It's the obligatoriness and their compliance is due to their religiousness. The one that refused would have refused even in an Islamic situation. Locks only keep honest people out. The criminal still is going to do criminal behavior whether you have a lock or not. So the majority who would submit to the judge's ruling will benefit from that. And the minority, that is the criminals who would refuse and only follow if there was mandatory physical force for them or the threat thereof, they're going to reject anyway. So there's much more benefit than for the habit than not having it. And in the end, it keeps the Sharia in the face of the people. so that when they do get in the position of authority, the Sharia is not foreign to them. Does that make sense?
Yes, it makes sense. But what is the difference in this case between a qadi and a mufti? Because just like the
there's a huge difference between a qadi and a mufti. A qadi makes a decision, okay, between people and their rights, and a mufti decides on an issue that is not clear or has not been spoken of in the era that he lives in, based upon what seems like a non-existent Islamic ruling stating what the ruling is. And he can promote that through paper, or he can announce it out loud. But what the qadi is doing is dealing with the rights of the people in their day-to-day activities, their business transactions, their marriage contracts, you know, family issues. This is what he's dealing with. Where the mufti is normally dealing with maybe similar issues, but he's not judging between two people. He's giving fatwa, and it's usually about a general issue that's affecting the whole society and not just one person. Or when I say one person, a group of people who are complaining about each other.
No.
That's all I had to say. I'm sorry.
Okay. All right. If the contract is rescinded before the consummation of marriage, the wife does not have the right to claim her dowry. This is because if she is the claimant of the rescinding of the marriage contract, then she is the one who causes the separation. On the other hand, if the husband was the claimant of the rescinding, then it means that she has not told him about her defect. In both cases, she does not have the right to claim her dowry. However, if the marriage is rescinded after consummation, the wife has the right to claim the dowry specified in the marriage contract. This is because the wife's dowry becomes obligatory for being stated in contract and settled by the consummation of the marriage, i.e. having sexual intercourse. Thus, the dowry becomes the wife's right and cannot be invalidated in this case.
Yes, this is why I told you before we had some cases of some women who were getting married every 2 years, it seemed, you know, or every other year and a half or something. It was just a game they were playing to get the dowry from the men. And then they would claim that the man didn't do something, or but he spent time with me. Privately, he saw me naked in this, that, and the other thing. So I want my dowry. You get my point?
No.
So just for the Sharia ruling, though, it's as you stated. Some make it even lighter than that. If he had been private with her, like I said, seeing her naked or with her with little or no clothes, spent the night with her in bed. All this is considered, hey, she's paid you've gotten something from her. She has to get paid for that. You get my point? She has to be compensated for you to have spent that time with her and been in that intimate proximity with her. Because it's not just having sex with the woman. It's, like I said, seeing her naked, laying in the bed with her and touching her, being up close with her in that regard. This is also considered by some equal to having sex with her. Or on par with it. I shouldn't say equal to it. Whereas the dowry would still be given to the person. This is why the tradition in the Christian marriage is that they're supposed to kiss the bride in front of everyone and then go and spend an hour privately together before they come to the party that they're having for each other, the coming out party. All that is to say, hey, look, everybody witnessed, you kissed her. The kiss is called kubul, which means acceptance, right? That's what the term kiss means in Arabic, kubul, acceptance. So, and you were alone with her, and you all changed your clothes together. You saw her unclothed. There's no backsies, bro. But it becomes a trick game, and we don't want it. Islam is not designed to make it a trick game. That's why the men should not get overwhelmed with doing it in such a fast manner and do it the way that the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam said, hey, you don't have to have your walima the same day. You know, take a look at what you got. Take a good look at the girl beforehand and afterwards. You know, I saw a funny thing on TV the other day. It said it was showing, it was a class on how to pick women. And the guy explained the different types of women. He had a nice board, how he put it together. And then he said, if you meet a woman that's like this, and he put this perfect woman like this, said she's not a woman, it's a man. You're talking to a transvestite. You know, and it was so funny. Because, you know, it was like this, he had put all these qualities together, and it was just hilarious the way he set it up, you know, as a joke for that part. But alhamdulillah, rabbil alameen. Continue.
Now, it is invalid to marry a young girl, an insane woman, or a slave girl to a man who is afflicted with a defect that affects the consummation of the marriage. This is because the wali is supposed to look for the best interest of the woman under his wilaya. Yet, if the wali is not acquainted with the suitor's defect, he is to rescind the marriage contract once he knows about it, in order to spare the woman under his wilaya the harmful consequences.
Yes, there was a man when I was in Egypt. Nice brother. Nothing wrong with him. He married a girl who was, I would say the word retarded because we use that word. But she didn't have Down syndrome. But she had, like, say, she was touched with, what's the word? Alzheimer's, let's say. Not Alzheimer's. What's it called? Autism.
I see.
So she was very childish. She was very, very childish. She was a grown woman, though. But it seemed like she was only, like, 13 or something, even though she was a grown woman. And her mother and her father married her to this man. And he was, and at first it seemed like, wow, how could you marry this girl who's, you know, very young in her mind, still a little girl in a grown woman's body, to this man? But when you saw them together, he was very gentle with her. She was like, oh, my husband, you know, she was just like a little girl. And, you know, that she was happy. She was very, very happy. Hey, you know, it was really funny, you know, because he was the perfect guy for her because he was so gentle with this girl, you know, and everything. And that was the first time I had seen a girl that we, like you say, an insane woman, because she's غير مكلفة in some things, you know. And she couldn't cook for him. She couldn't do those other things for him. And half the time she was with her mother. You know, half the time she's back home. You know, so I thought it was very beautiful that she could have some suhbah. She could have a good husband and continue to live, even though her situation was what it was. So I just want to say I witnessed that. And I saw it's very, very beautiful. It's not like people think that it's abusive to a girl to get married when she has, you know, autism or something like that. Okay, because you know that's what it comes across in the West like that sometimes.
Nah,
the wali has to be familiar with the woman's situation. He has to know about the woman that he's the wali for, and that's why people shouldn't just jump in and say this guy is going to be my wali, you know, eeny meeny miny mo type of thing. They should look for mature, notable men, experienced men, who will understand different issues so they can tell that wali about their situation, and he can then look for a good suitor and be on the watch out for people who are not good for that particular type of woman. Like, especially nowadays when women have come from some abuse situations and war-torn situations, that, you know, mandates that you treat them a different way. Like when I would find women in some other country, African-American woman. And if I was made the wali over those women, I would make sure I tried to find a guy that would not beat them up, because they've already been beaten up. You know what I'm saying? It's still, the hit is not going to help them. You know what I'm saying? It's not going to. Whereas if you hit certain type of women, and it's a rights man, a man's right to spank his wife or something like that, that might help her. That might stop her situation. But for people coming from the West, who've already been, you know, in abusive and been ultrally high, sensitive, violent, you know, societies, a strike is not going to help that situation. It's just going to feed to their PTSD, you know, and the expectation of dysfunctionism. So the Wali has to know what the people have gone through, what the women have gone through under his watch, so that he can be careful about finding a good spouse for that person, that person's situation. And that's what's mentioned here. And he doesn't know until he finds out after the marriage, and he has to break the marriage. He has to rescind the marriage, meaning he takes a khula. That's what rescind means. The one who made you, and so he's giving a point here that you should pay attention to. The wali has to, read that part again, please.
Yet if the guardian, so I'll marry, I'll just read the whole paragraph. It is invalid to marry a young girl, an insane woman, or a slave girl to a man who is afflicted with a defect that affects the consummation of the marriage. This is because the guardian is supposed to look for the best interest of the woman under his guardianship. Yet if the guardian is not acquainted with the suitor's defect, he is to rescind the marriage contract once he knows about it, in order to spare the woman under his guardianship the harmful consequences.
Okay, so how does he rescind the marriage? See, he threw that in there, and if you're not paying attention, you miss it. He gets a khula. He initiates it. Now, how come he can initiate it? Because the one that made her lawful for him was him. And he's the same one that can make her unlawful for him. Does that make sense?
No.
Continue.
Is he saying that because it's thought that maybe the woman wouldn't do it herself?
Yes.
No.
Exactly. Because don't women stay in abusive situations?
Yeah, especially if it's how the Sheikh mentioned that she's young or insane or something.
Not even if she's young or insane, even if she's older. You know, I found older women sometimes stay in those situations more than younger women. Sometimes the younger women are spicy, but the older women are like, hey, I don't have any other choices here. Okay? What am I going to do? I want to have a husband. I want somebody. I don't want to be by myself. So they tend to put up with it more than the young girls do. So, you know, it's not an age thing necessarily. It's a thing where they talk about it in men are from Mars and women from Venus, that the way women in psychology is different from men. They count by ones, but they never give up points. So if a man has gained some points with her, she always gives him that credit. Okay? And actually, I was just listening to a case yesterday about a man who kidnapped a girl. He went to the parents of this young lady and told them, I'll kill you if you don't give me that pretty little girl. And so they gave it to her. And then he signed a paper and let her marry her. She was about 13 years old. And she stayed with him like 10 years until someone killed him. And she wanted to testify against the guys who did it, even though this guy had abused her, put her in the hospital, you know, and all this other stuff like that. Why? They said, oh, she had, what do you call it, syndrome, you know, was it Thromberg's or whatever the syndrome is, where the victim is falling for their oppressor.
Stockholm syndrome.
Stockholm syndrome. Thank you very much. That's what they tried to say. I said, no, she's a woman. And it's from the nature of the woman not to run from the guy who's feeding her, the guy who's taking her captive. Okay? She's just not in her nature. She is sheepish in that way. Don't you see that we call women the booty, meaning they're the war booty. The same guy that killed her husband, her father, her son, is the same guy that, you know, she stays as his wife or his slave. And you never hear of them killing him in his sleep. Not saying it probably doesn't happen here and there, but it's so rare, it's not the norm, is it?
No, Sheikh.
Why does she stay with him then, you know, Judge Apprentice?
Because she feels like she has nowhere to go.
Right. So it's in her nature. to stay with this guy, even though he killed her family. Okay, or is in the army that killed her family. Or he's abusing her in some way. The one that steps in is the family member, the father or the wali. He has the right to step in and say, I don't like this situation for my ward. I'm taking her out of your hands. Who are you to take her out of my hands? Who made her lawful for you? You did. Well, I can make her unlawful for you too. And that's the right of the wali and the father. You find some fuqaha saying he can only do it if he's a blood relative. You find others saying, no, as long as he was her wali, he can take her out of the marriage. What we find is that there's less problems when it's her father or her brother. Okay, because as being a blood relative, it's hard to push that guy away. And we see more problematic and refused when it's not her brother or blood relative or father, because then the guy says, hey, you're trying to take my wife. Yeah, I'm not going for that, blah, 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 blah. The way we solved it in the United States, because we had we still have a marriage court with Sheikh Adli and myself, and there was other people. We had it up and down the East Coast. Is we would have as many imams as possible sign off on the situation. If we can get three, if we can get five, we usually got five. Five imams who listened to the case and decided we're going to take this woman out of that marriage. And we all put our signature on that, you know, that ruling. And we present it to the husband. He can't deny five imams. He can deny one. He can even deny two. Once it gets to three or four or five, the imam saying, hey, we all agree that this woman is no longer your wife. We're giving her a khula. He can't say anything. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir. It makes sense.
Alhamdulillah. Continue.
Nah. In this connection, if a sane, mature woman gives her consent to marry an impotent man, or one whose penis is amputated, the guardian does not have the right to prevent the marriage, as sexual intercourse is a matter that concerns the bride alone, no one else. However, if she accepts to marry an insane...
This is known at first. This is before they consummate. Before the marriage, so she knows. So she can't complain about it afterwards.
Nah. However, if she accepts to marry an insane person, a leper, or a man afflicted with vitiligo, her guardian can prevent the marriage in this case, as the negative effects of the husband's defect may exceed the wife to befall their children, in addition to the blemish that may befall the family. That's the end of the chapter.
This makes the situation a little bit complicated, because they're always going to argue. The wali might say, no, I'm not going to allow this to happen because this is too much. Well, no, it doesn't make a difference. So, you know, that's always going to be the issue of ikhtilaf right there. Go ahead.
Now, chapter 8, marriage of disbelievers. Disbelievers here refers to the Christians, the Jews, and the people of other beliefs such as magi and idolaters. This chapter deals with the rulings on the marriages of such disbelievers if they convert to Islam or seek the judgment of the Islamic judiciary concerning marital cases while they are still disbelievers. The rulings on the marriages of the disbelievers are the same as those on the marriages of Muslims with respect to validity, divorce, zihar, ila, alimony, and the nights one spends with one's wives. That is to say, the women a disbelieving man is prohibited to marry are the same as those prohibited for a Muslim man to marry, such as the mother, the sister, etc. This is because the disbelieving married women here are referred to as wives in the Quran. Allah exalted be He says what may mean, and his wife as well, the carrier of firewood. Quran, Suratul Masad, Ayah 4. Allah also says what may mean, and the wife of Fir'aun said, Quran, Suratul Qasas, Ayah 9.
The ruling here is that the term is used for Muslim and non-Muslim, but we do not change our standard. So we don't judge by their broken standard and say, okay, they can have zina or they can have marry their sisters. No. We say the rules stand for all of us. Continue.
Naam. Hence, referring to those disbelieving women as wives in the Quran indicates the validity of their marriage. Shaykh al-Islam ibn Taymiyyah, may Allah have mercy on him, said, the sound opinion is that the marriages of disbelievers which are viewed prohibited in Islam are absolutely prohibited in any other religion. If they do not convert to Islam, they will be punished for them in the hereafter, but if they become Muslim, they will be pardoned for them, as they have been unaware of the prohibition of such marriages. As for the validity or invalidity of such marriages, they are viewed valid from one perspective and invalid from another. If what is meant by validity is the lawfulness of taking full responsibility as a couple and fulfilling the marriage contract, then the validity of their marriage in this case is dependent on its consummation according to the Islamic regulations. However, if what is meant by validity is the enforceability of the rulings pertaining to marriage, such as the rescindment of the marriage contract due to a threefold irrevocable divorce, the effectiveness of divorce, and the establishment of marriage and the resultant chastity, then the marriage is deemed valid. End of the Imam's words. Among the rulings on the disbelievers' marriages is that their invalid marriages are to be conceded to on two conditions. A. Their invalid marriages are to be conceded by Muslims if they believe them to be valid in their creed. Whatever marriages they do not deem valid are not to be conceded, as they are not admitted in their religion.
And their religion meaning the religion of the Kufar.
Naam. B. Their invalid marriages are to be conceded as long as they do not seek the judgment of the Islamic judiciary in this concern. But if they do, the Muslims are not to concede such marriages. This is because Allah, exalted be He, says what may mean, and judge, O Muhammad, between them by what Allah has revealed. Quran, Surah Al-Ma'idah, Ayah 49.
That's what I was saying to you. So as we look at their marriage, we say, okay, you guys are married. But if they come to us, we live by our criteria. We don't live by theirs. We stick to our criteria, the criteria that Allah has set. Continue.
Naam. In this regard, if the disbelievers believe in the validity of their marriages according to their creed and do not seek the Islamic judgment, we are not to disapprove of them. To illustrate, the Prophet ﷺ took jizya from the Magi of Hajar and did not object to their marriages, although he ﷺ knew that they allowed marrying their legally unmarriageable kin. In addition, many people converted to Islam in the lifetime of the Prophet ﷺ, and he conceded their marriages without pointing out the way they were consummated.
Meaning that he didn't make them get remarried when they came into Islam. Okay, this is why we say that street marriages, what we call hood marriages in the United States, they didn't go down to the courthouse. They didn't go and have a walima and stuff like that. They didn't go to the church and do it or nothing. They was just, you know, this is my girl. They accepted themselves to be married, and everybody recognized that they married. When they came to Islam, they didn't have to do nothing. Okay, that's his girl. That's the way they was. That's the way they've been, you know. So whatever the culture is, it goes back to that. Whenever a people's culture can, you know, cannot be denied, then the people's culture has to be applied. It can be applied. Boom. So that's just one thing. Abu Bakr and Omar and all of those people, they didn't get remarried. When a man came in, he had so many wives. What did he tell him? Yo, you can only have four. You got to get rid of the others. He didn't say those are invalid marriages. Yo, you just like this. Nah, you have to now, you know, break it down to what we accept. Okay? Tafaddal.
Question about that, Sheikh.
Tafaddal.
I'm not aware of any people in America. You had a, or no, I don't know if it's America, but he had a girl who's been together for 10 years, but everybody know that's his girl, but they won't say that he married, though. They'd be like, they ain't married.
No, but that's nowadays. That's a new thing, though. You know, when I was, we're talking about it, it's a different era. Every era changes. So when the culture changes, the mentalities change, and you have to make your rulings based on what is the accepted norm. There was time where it was like, yo, that's his girl, and that meant that's his girl. You know what I'm saying? That word meant that that was his wife and nobody else's. And that if she couldn't go and be with nobody else because that was not culturally accepted. That's his girl, and he wasn't with nobody else either. You understand? See, you what you're missing is that in my lifetime, we were still, even though I was a baby, we coming out of Jim Crow apartheid. So the things that the community did not always include the government in a lot of different areas. And what was done, a lot of it was done quietly and hidden from government interference. Does that make sense?
That makes sense. Still apply that's nowadays.
Okay, well, that's the point. The point is that you have to make that determination. Oh, judge, you know, apprentice, you have to figure that out and know the culture well enough to know what do these people mean by that. Okay, because now they got people, they call us wifey, right? You got people that say, yo, that's my wife, that's my baby mama, that's what it is. And they run it just like a marriage, and sometimes better than people's other marriages. What is their thing? That's up for you to determine by knowing the culture well. Okay, and thinking about it and how it can be included, not trying to exclude it just to be exclusive.
Understood, Dick. So if somebody, say, that happened to a pair, a couple, they wouldn't be making Xena then, I guess.
I can't hear you.
Oh, sorry. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can now.
Okay, so what I'm thinking right now is, they were never married downtown or whatever, then how do we give the ruling of them making Xena? Like, I guess.
Okay. Well, then, okay. See, again, what do they consider Xena? I mean, I don't see it being hard. I don't know. Most people I know never got married downtown at all.
You know, right. That's what I understand that.
I think that's
marriage. That's what I'm saying.
Right. Well,
how do we consider that a marriage then?
Let me answer you.
Yes, sir.
Well, would they consider it Xena? Okay? You have people that you know that's his baby mama, or that's not even his baby mama. They consider that's his girl. But if he wouldn't have sex with another woman, what would she consider that? Yo, you cheated on me. Right?
Yes. Yes, for sure.
So, I mean, I don't want to stop the class and just get in the whole issue about that particular the details on how the tafsil of all that, because there's got to be a lot of tafsil, and you can't really get to it until you deal with a particular situation. But in general, if they looked at themselves as an item, as that, yo, we are together, this is us, okay? And it's not like, yo, and there's a process for them to a breaking up and all that stuff like that, and that's his girl, you know. Not this, because you know the younger people, they might do a thing. Yo, he's just with a girl for a couple of weeks, and then they hitting it and missing. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about people with long term marriages, long term relationships, and those relationships are as solid as a marriage is. That has to be looked at. Does that make sense?
It makes sense.
There's a lot of social studies that have to be taken into consideration when you guys are making rulings. Okay? The judge is well read, well up to speed with what's going on in the streets and who the people are. Just look at some of these judges on TV. You know, look at some of the ones that they have and their cases are being shown. I'm not talking about Judge Brown and stuff like that, but they have some real good judges out there. Yeah, some are like pieces of crap, and they promote their racism and their socialism and stuff like that. But there are some that you can see from listening to them how in tune they are with what is happening and the circumstances behind the crime. And that's what you, that's what's very important for at this moment for me to make as a point, that you have to be able to get into the mind of the circumstances behind the crime, the mindset, okay? The public opinion. That's why you see in all these cases, they always talk about what's the public's interest in this. And a judge will sometimes rule and say, well, it's in the public's interest. Okay? Because the public's mentality is part of it. And it's the same thing we have in Islam. Whenever the people's, what's their urf? What is the urf of the people at this time? How are they going to look at that? So, becoming an Islamic judge also includes learning what it is just to be a judge. Okay?
Nam, Sheikh, are there any judges in particular or any channels you'd recommend for us to study?
No, at this point, first things first. You mean on television you're talking about like that or Islamic?
On television, YouTube, whatever. Anything.
Yeah, there are some that I can point you to. I'd have to go and figure out their names. There's a couple I see that pop on my feed sometimes that, and I watch them and I say, oh wow, I like the way this guy goes about doing stuff. There's a lot of lessons that can be learned from that. You know, especially since any field that you go into, you should absorb so much about it so that it becomes second nature to you, get used to it. Also, it's recommended to read books on law and books on judges and stuff like that. There's an excellent book called How Judges Judge. Okay, I read that book. It's an excellent book. And there's a couple of other books that are similar to that that give you the mindset of judges.
Sheikh, you mentioned that book before, but I couldn't find it because there's many books with that title. Well, who was the author of that book?
Oh my goodness, I don't remember. I'd have to go look at some of the titles to see what the cover looks like, and I can remember it because I found it some years ago, and I didn't know there were so many of them.
Do you remember how long it was? What year it was published? Anything?
No, I don't remember any of that stuff. I read that book. It was some years ago. Like I said, it was years ago I read that book. And so I don't remember the author or anything like that. I never even paid attention to the author, who the author was at the time. But I would look at some of those books and if I was you and to see if there was some benefit in reading a few of them. Because, okay. I mean, I don't know, you know, which one would be better or the other. There might be some even better. But I would try to look at them and if... You know, I don't know. See which one appeals to you and give it a shot. Say Bismillah and give it a shot. Maybe you benefit from it, you know?
Okay.
Yeah. But it's definitely a knowledge that, and if there's lots of titles, I'm just thinking about out loud. If there's a number of them like that, this must be the same criteria that they're talking about. You know, it might be the same type of thing going over around and just presented in different ways. You know?
No.
Or you can Google it and say, what's the best book that gives me a shot at looking at how judges judge or teaches me this? You can, you know, check that on Google or ChatGPT, whatever it is called, you know, and check like that, you know.
Okay.
And what I found is when I studied that book, I found things like that in the Quran. For example, sometimes a judge will punish a person even though the punishment is not going to solve anything. Okay? What's he going to do then? It's going to be nakalan lighayrihi, ibratan lighayrihi. It's going to be such a severe punishment that anyone else who thinks about doing this crime will remember the punishment that was received from the crime. So the punishment might be a prevention from someone committing it again. That's one of the reasons why judges judge, right? To teach everyone else to make prevention for someone else from committing the crime. And sometimes the judge judges in order to pay back the person who was offended, depending on what the crime was. So now you have to give money or do something like that to give the person back. So he's judging for justice. Or to teach the culprits a lesson, the judge may make them do public services and stuff like that, clean things up, pay money for this, that, to teach them to respect certain aspects of public life, you know, if they, depending on the violation. These are just some of the reasons why a judge judges and makes the rulings that he does. So that was, when I listen to that, when I start reading the Quran, and I see that in the Quran as well, you know, that Allah turns them to kiradatin wa khanazir, turned them into pigs and monkeys. Why? Okay? In order to be an example for others. Okay? No, this punishment wasn't going to help them. They died 3 days later, some say. Some say they just died out in a short period of time. The point is that their punishment didn't make them get better. It was not rehabilitatory, as some punishments are to rehabilitate the criminal, right? That's the normal one. Give him this punishment, this will rehabilitate him. Chop his hand off, okay? Beat him 10 times, beat him 100 times. This is going to rehabilitate that person. But the other crime, the other punishments, none of those were, except for the one that they had to pay something, was to rehabilitate them. So these are just some of the reasoning behind judging, how a judge judges. Okay, but that's at the punishment stage. Okay, the other parts of it is, you know, what the judge looks at. Again, how his attitude is, what he takes into consideration. Those things like that. And that's after we've looked and learned the law.
No.
And so you'll find in American law, for example, they'll have a probation report, right? A pre-sentencing report. The pre-sentencing report is the report that's supposed to give the background of the person who's being sentenced. So the judge can now take that into consideration. Okay, before he sentences this person, he has to get to know. Give me a biography of this person. Where did he grow up? What happened to him? What's his criminal history? What's his social history? You know, how old is he? How many parents does he have? What type of lifestyle does he live in? All these things is in the pre-sentence report for that reason. No. Does any of this make any sense?
No, yes, it makes sense, all of it.
Continue.
Now, if a disbelieving couple comes to Muslims seeking their judgment before the consummation of their marriage, Muslims are to conclude it in accordance with the religion of Islam, i.e. there must be the groom's spoken proposal, the bride's consent, the bride's guardian, and two equitable Muslim witnesses. Allah exalted be He says what may mean, and if you judge, judge between them with justice. Quran, Surah Al-Ma'idah, Ayah 42. However, if a disbelieving couple seeks the Islamic judgment after the consummation of their marriage, Muslims are not to object to the manner of its consummation. Similarly, if the two disbelieving spouses convert to Islam, Muslims are not to object to the way their marriage was consummated, or whether the conditions for its validity were there or not. Rather, if such a couple comes seeking the Islamic judgment regarding their marriage, Muslims are to consider that matter at the time when they seek the Islamic judgment or the time of their conversion to Islam. Hence, if the wife, then, is among the women lawful for her husband to marry as a Muslim without any legal barrier, the marriage is to be approved of. Since there has been no legal barrier from the beginning, there's nothing to prevent maintaining the marriage after their conversion to Islam. Yet if the wife is originally prohibited for the man to marry at the time when they seek the Islamic judgment or at the time of their conversion to Islam, they are to be separated. This is because the invalidity of their marriage contract from the beginning causes the prohibition of its being continued. As for the dowry specified for the wife before their conversion to Islam, if it is something lawful, she can have it, for it's her due right according to the marriage contract, and there's no legal reason preventing its being given to her. However, if the dowry is something corrupt or unlawful, such as wine and swine, there will be two rulings. First, if the wife has already received it as her dowry, then it is deemed fulfilled, i.e. she is not entitled to get something instead, as she has received it according to their previous creed, i.e. disbelief. Thus, the obligation of the dowry is deemed fulfilled on the part of the husband. Moreover, if Muslims raise their objection on such matters, it will cause difficulty and disincline people to convert to Islam.
This is what we found out. This is what we found out back in East Orange days. Myself and Abu Muslim, I was like, look, if we make rulings like this, we'd be breaking all types of families up. All people that, you know, come in, because, you know, a lot of drug dealers and let's call it black market, underground, people were coming to Islam. And they were coming to Islam with their women, both of them at the same time, coming and taking Shahada. And they're always like, yo, this, they would present themselves like let's say, listen to this, Abu Sa'id. Yo, this is my girl. We're gonna take the Shahada. You know? And they would take the Shahada, she put the khimar on and stuff like that. And they go, they marry. That's now they walk out, they marry. Wasn't nothing, we didn't do anything, we didn't break the law, you can't be with you can't really do get away with that sometimes with people as well. You know, they living together, they've been together, they got children together, you know, and you talking to gangsters too. The reality of it. We talk about the man who killed 100 people. You know, they say, look, just on that alone, you should have told him, yeah, man, you forgiven. Peace. Be out. Even if you didn't believe that. That's one of the Mufassirun said that, you know, if a man came to me that said he admitted that he killed 99 people and asked me if he's forgiven, I'd say, yes, sir. You know, even if I didn't believe it. So the man, the abid was ignorant, he said, jahil, not realizing the situation he was under in that situation. I'm saying the same thing when somebody comes to you sincerely. And these, you know, when people come to you sincerely about Islam, they are serious. They are at the height of their seriousness at the moment. They're not taking no wooden nickels and things like that. And then you start telling them, no, Islam isn't set up that way. Islam is as inclusive as it can be. As you see from these rulings here, any way possible we can include them to be married, we include them. That's the nature of this whole statement that we're going, all these statements are going through. Any way possible. Even to the point we're saying she got something haram for her dowry. As long as she got it before she came to Islam and she accepted it, yo, it's cool, whatever. But if they try to do it at the moment they got married, now we say, no, you can't do that now. That's not allowable. But if they did it yesterday, cool, peace, it's done. Even if it was khamr, right? Even if it was something haram. So the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, the principle here is bashiru wa la tunaffiru, include, don't exclude. Yassiru wa la tu'assiru, make it simple, you know, make it easy and don't make it complicated. Islam wipes out everything that went before. What's she going to be now? It's my wife. All right, that's cool. Let's keep moving.
Nah, Sheikh, there's a very interesting situation I want to ask you about.
How do you know it's interesting? I'm messing with you. Go ahead.
I think you'll find it interesting.
Nah, fuck them.
And it's related to this topic. So here in Philippines, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, Philippines, as you know, is a country with many Muslims in it. But it is a Catholic country, and the laws are based on originally the Catholic, then the American laws. And one strange thing about that is that there's no divorce law in Philippines.
I know that, yeah.
Right.
I know that.
So what the people... So same this thing puts in Spain. The people,
did you know that? Same thing in Spain.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yep.
So this puts the people in a very hard situation, and what ends up happening is when a couple wants to break up, they just break up, and they don't make it legal. So they're still legally married to each other, but they're with someone else. And this means they can't travel with the person. This means this has a whole lot of other ramifications.
And it ramifications.
It puts people in a very hard situation. So what happened was, a few years ago, as you also know, the Muslims in Philippines were at war with the Catholics for a long time. And that war was settled under a man named Duterte, who was the previous president here. And the one of the conditions of that agreement was that the Catholics, the Catholic Philippines government, must recognize the divorce of Muslims, right? So they were given their own court system. They were given their own, you know, separate legal process. And as a result of that, a whole lot of Catholics, well, I don't know exactly how many, but a whole lot of Catholic Filipinos began faking conversion to Islam to get divorced, or so they say. Allahu alam. But this was what was reported and what was widespread. I've actually heard this too from one of the brothers working at the Muslim agency. He said most people who come here, they don't know the five pillars of Islam. They don't know how to pray. They don't know anything. They just say, "I'm Muslim. Give me my official conversion sheet, and let me go on my way." And you know, he's like, "No, I have to teach you something. You have to learn something about this." You know, so what would be your how would you handle cases like this, right? Of someone who wants to divorce, and they're coming saying, "We want to become Muslim."
Okay, I would not ask them what their reason is. I would give them shahada. I would say, "Okay, if you want your conversion, repeat after me. Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah, ashhadu anna Muhammadan Rasulullah." Tell them what that means in the Filipino language. This is what that is. You are now Muslim. May Allah bless you and enter you into Jannah. And I walk by my business and go home happy every day because those people took shahada. Okay? Those people took shahada. Maybe their reasoning is stupid. Maybe their reasoning is just to get under the oppression of the Catholic Church. And that's not a stupid reason now. That's a good reason. Okay? And may Allah allow them to go to Jannah for that. Because they're acknowledging that the Islamic way is better. Okay? And I would say, you know, not everybody has to be a theologian. Not everybody has to be this righteous Muslim and stuff like that. You know? They took shahada. You know? There was a statement. The reason why I say take that stance is, you know, I accepted Islam because I smelt the oil and I saw the people in the clothes and I was impressed with Malcolm X and and Muhammad Ali. I had no idea what shahada was. I didn't know anything about Tawheed. Not at all. If you'd approached me about it, I would have said, "Man, get out of my face with that." You know, I had not even a consciousness of that. Okay? So Allah, they may be the way they enter in, but not the way they go out. Meaning pass through the death.
No.
You know? So, yeah, man, I would say, and I would make dua for them, that Allah, you know, yahdihim, you know, and yurshiduhum ila sawab. Alhamdulillah, Rabbil Alameen.
Alhamdulillah, that's the beautiful character of Islam.
Yeah, you know, samha, wasabr. These are the characteristics of Islam. Allowances, you know, and sabr, and dua, and husnudhan. You know, husnudhan. You know, so they will see how precious that shahada is. You know, I remember why you're saying that. This is the same thing I was saying to Abu Sa'id, is that in, you know, in the 70s and even in the beginning of the 80s, you know, you had people who were divorced, but they were not divorced. They were not divorced legally. And they were not even living with some people. Like, I remember there was a woman who died, and a guy came to the funeral, and they were like, "Yeah, who was that?" And I heard old people say, "Oh, that's her husband." Her husband? Hey, he with Miss So and So. Yo, they never got divorced. You know they ain't never got divorced. He just moved down the block. So all this time, everybody thought he was the wife of the husband of the other lady, but he was actually the husband of this lady up the street. All our life. Because black folk didn't get divorced. They didn't go to the court. That tunnel, people, yo, divorces. They didn't have the strength to do that. Even though they probably could have gotten away with it, in their heads, they couldn't do it. You understand? No. Even though Jim Crow apartheid was over, try to encourage them to go in there. You must be they remember too much bad stuff to even go there. You feel me?
No, I understand.
So is that zina for them, or is that a response to oppression when you have no other way out? You know, so I don't see them as making zina in that regard. I see them as finding a feasible solution to a problem that their societies have not provided a solution for. Okay. Alhamdulillah.
Nah, that's one of the most beautiful aspects of Islam, in my opinion, is that it provides solutions for people.
For everything. Continue.
Nah. Therefore, such matters are pardoned due to the married couple's conversion to Islam, just like all other acts disbelievers used to practice before their conversion to Islam. Second, if the wife has not got such an unlawful dowry, then a proper lawful dowry, like that given to ones like her, is to be specified for her. However...
Right, so we asked that. Did you give her a dowry? Okay, did you? No, I ain't giving me nothing. Yo, shorty, you owe her this, that, and everything. And at that moment, people are feeling generous. Here, well, here, take this, take that, boo. You know, and then you can help them out. If they ain't got nothing, you give them something. Right? You make them walk away happy. That's when you go into the sadaqa box and say, hey, look, well, this we're going to give this to you as your dowry from him. Right, my man? All right, cool. Thank you. You know?
Nah. Continue. However, if she's already received part of her unlawful dowry during the time of disbelief, the other part is to be estimated and given to her according to the proper lawful dowry, like that given to ones like her. Similarly, if her dowry has not been specified before converting to Islam, then she is to receive a proper lawful dowry, like that given to ones like her, as it is invalid not to specify a dowry in the marriage contract. Sheikh, what if in the culture of these people, the woman gives the man a dowry?
I mean, correct it at the time of the conversion.
Oh, okay.
Like he said, you know. We asked the lady, oh, did you, you know, you guys are, you know, married, you guys are a couple? Yeah, you know, however you can word it. You want to word it to conclude, right? Not to exclude. Okay? And he said, yeah, you know, did you give her a dowry? Well, it's a dowry. You know, you have to give her a free gift. Yeah, brother, you got to give me a free gift. You know, and she'll tell you, you know, I gave him, you know. He says, well, look, you know, this house kind of going right down. You know, you guys are married, you know, your couple, you're still together and everything Islamic acknowledges that. But you owe her, man. You got what you gonna give her? You know, what this is what you know normally is given for this type of person, and you work it out with them. You know,
is her dowry to him considered a dowry or just like a gift?
No, it's not considered. Okay. No, it's not. It's considered kufr, and it's all wiped away.
Okay,
you don't have to even get involved with that. Remember, you guys gotta have some flavor, man. You guys have you're gonna be dealing with people on multiple levels. You know, you have to find ways to solution it for them without and leave the people with dignity. Right?
Nah. Moreover, if the two spouses convert to Islam at the same time, their marriage is to be maintained, as there is no religious distinction between them. Furthermore, if the husband of a Christian or a Jewish woman converts to Islam, whereas she does not, their marriage is to be maintained, as a Muslim man is originally allowed to marry a Christian or Jewish woman. So it's valid, with greater reason, to maintain her as a wife after the husband's conversion to Islam.
And we see this a lot, too. This is something we saw a lot of. You know, guys come to Islam and their wife is Christian. We didn't see it work out well, but we saw a lot of people come to Islam like this. You know, and it's usually the Christian woman who wants the divorce. It's Christian woman that's like, yo, forget it. I want, you know, this, that. You ain't going to do this to my children. They only go to court and get rulings against the guy in the Christian court, you know. You don't really see it happening with the Jewish women. They usually don't have a problem with it because they're usually more educated about what Islam is, whereas the Christian people are more emotionally, you know, charged against it because they're jahil, you know, they're ignorant of it. And so all they know is what TV told them. Okay?
Naam. On the other hand, if a disbelieving woman converts to Islam while being married to a disbeliever and before the consummation of the marriage, their marriage is invalidated. Allah, exalted be He, says what may mean, and do not return them to the disbelievers. They are not lawful wives for them, nor are they lawful husbands for them. Quran, Surah Al-Mumtahina, Ayah 10.
Yeah, so this is another issue we have a lot of times, because we find women come into Islam and they're married to these Christian guys, or guys that just, they call themselves Christian, or they don't even call themselves nothing. And they don't walk away from the marriage. We can't force them to walk away from the marriage. You know, it's you know, and it's or even seen as though we're trying to take dude's girl and, you know, you try to convert them and bring them to your crib. Nah, we gotta be real suave about that. She has to want to leave.
Nam, I see. Okay, I'm just writing this down. Okay.
And sometimes we give the guy, we tell him, stop having sex with him. That's what we tell him. Please stop having sex with him and, you know, give him a couple of days, like 3 days to, you know, make a decision what he's going to do. And then in that time, you can get sisters involved to talk to her and help her and give an alternative to her. But it's hard for people to break apart their lives after they've been set up like that. So it's, you know, there's a lot of, especially in the West, where you don't have as much monetary resources for Islamic institutions. Because it's always pouring in. We have never set it up as a waqf where it makes money and feeds itself. You know?
I see.
Can you guys hear me?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Nah.
And what I mean by that is like a halfway house for the brothers when they're coming out of prison, a conversion center, a place where women can have a shelter and a place to stay. You know what I'm saying? A bus to take women that are not married or don't have men to the store and back safely, you know, on a weekly, you know, basis and stuff like that. Some places, you know, we don't have any of those things set up. No communal services. In fact, the community don't even live around each other. Okay? So this is our problem in the West.
No.
And nothing is stopping us from doing any of those things. That's the thing about it. We can't claim we don't have authority, because in the West, you do have the authority to do that, the opportunity, the allowance.
I think it's trust.
You just have not.
The lack of trust.
No, it's not that at all. We've built many, many masjids. It's just that the people who are involved in doing those things are not the educated amongst us, nor are they people who care about the conversion of people. They've mostly come from their own countries and are only looking for their immigrant community to take part in the American dream. And they have no interest in the converts. And that is shown in, look at any community, all the issues that were set up for converts in the 70s and the 80s and the early 90s are all gone now. Except on a plastic level, where people are doing this, what do they call it? Was it a thing where you know, unisex or not? Well, not unisex, unifaith, or what's it called?
Interfaith.
Interfaith, yeah. Except for that, which is more political than and a show, dog and pony show, than it is any effective way of dealing with people in the community.
Nah. Accordingly, the woman in this case does not have the right to claim her dowry, as the rescindment of the marriage is on her part. Similarly, if a husband of a disbelieving woman who is neither Christian nor Jew converts to Islam before the consummation of marriage, their marriage is invalidated. Allah, exalted be He, says what may mean, and hold not to marriage bonds with disbelieving women. Quran, Surah Al-Mumtahina, Ayah 10. In this case, the man has to pay her half the dowry, as the rescindment of marriage is on his part. In this connection, if one of the two disbelieving spouses, who are neither Christians nor Jews, converts to Islam, or if a disbelieving woman converts to Islam after the consummation of her marriage to a disbeliever, the matter becomes dependent on the wife's waiting period. In other words, if one of them converts to Islam during the wife's waiting period, their marriage is to be maintained as valid. However, if the other spouse does not convert to Islam during that period, their marriage is deemed invalid since one spouse has converted to Islam. In addition, he who converts to Islam while having more than four wives who have converted to Islam too, or who are Christians and Jews, has to choose only four of them to keep as wives. This is based on the fact that when Qais ibn al-Harith converted to Islam while having eight wives, the Prophet ﷺ said to him, select four wives to keep of them. The Prophet ﷺ said the same to others on similar occasions, and Allah knows best.
Alhamdulillah, Rabbil Alameen. You know, anytime I hear about, you know, four wives and, you know, three wives, I realize how rich Islam is and how beautiful marriage is, you know, and how miskeen monogamy is, in my opinion. You know, I think it's so much more fulfilling, and that we're missing so much of what life could be like by restricting it to a monogamous relationship. No. It's just my opinion. And no. I think it's much stressful, less stressful to have more than one. Because I have two wives, so I can only imagine, you know, I can only imagine that, you know, three must be on another level. I'm not at that level, but, you know, I don't think I could ever really go back to monogamy. I think that would be so constraining, you know? Yeah, of course.
That's how I feel about it too.
Yeah, you know, alhamdulillah.
I'm just saying what the Sheikh said about going from two to three, that's how I feel about going to two.
I feel the same way. You know, that's the thing that stops me from even trying that, because I know that it's not fair to push yourself in a way that would oppress others, because you wind up oppressing yourself. So there has to be that first part. There has to be the criteria. But we should be striving towards that. And if we were really striving towards that, we can do it without running around like a chicken with a head cut off too. Because then I've seen brothers who have multiple wives. I've seen some brothers with four wives, and they are just like single guys. I'm like, yo, you missed the boat, bro. You missed the whole objective of wives. Because they're just like, they're living in their car. And I say, man, it doesn't look fun the way those guys are doing it. But I think that they just, you know, they put the cart before the horse. So now they're chasing it as it rolls downhill, you know? Yeah, if you do it in the balanced Islamic way, then you miss out on having that challenge, that problem, you know? Alhamdulillah. Women should never feel, you know, endangered because of your finances. Okay? Now I'm going to divorce you because I can't afford you. No, man, that's crazy. You know? So men have to do their part. Alhamdulillah.
Naam. Well, this is the end of the chapter.
Alhamdulillah. This is where we, you know, end today. Jazakumullah khair. I told you this is going to be our last, you know, section when we finish through marital laws. And marital laws are so interesting, so very interesting, so important to get the gist of. Okay? It's very important. All right, let's end here. Tafadhal.
Naam. So we'll end here. Today we talked about a very important topic, which was marriage. And that is one of the 38 chapters of fiqh. So Jazakallah khair, Sheikh, and thank you all for joining us on Outlining Fiqh. But let's not rush things. If hadith, usul, and histories are still partially clouded in mysteries, refrain yourself from speaking, for what can you teach? To have little knowledge and teach is to cheat. Go back to the graph and the knowledge within. There are 38 chapters to finish. Let's begin.